Matthew 12. Now, what's interesting is the morning that I was putting together this message, it was right about the time when Mardi Gras was taking place in New Orleans. Now, Mardi Gras was a celebration, was celebrated for the first time on February 27th, 1827. According to a National Geographic report, on that day, a group of students in masks and costumes paraded through the streets, partying and dancing. I'm going to read the article. Mardi Gras falls on the day before Ash Wednesday each year. Mardi Gras Day is the culmination of the carnival season, a weeks-long party of excessive, over-the-top celebrations. There are parades, live music, festivals, and balls held during carnival, complete with colorful costumes, detailed masks, tons of delicious food, and lots of booze. Mardi Gras became a time for people to let loose before the 40 days of inner reflection and repenting between Ash Wednesday and Easter Sunday, getting out of their system everything that is forbidden during Lent. Modern day carnival and Mardi Gras have evolved into more secular celebrations, but the spirit of revelry and debauchery is just as fierce. Now, there's a reason I made reference to this. The history of Mardi Gras actually goes back centuries to pagan celebrations of spring and fertility. Question: could what we're seeing taking place today in the New Orleans and these cities all over the world that celebrate this type of celebration, could all that have a connection to events that occurred thousands of years ago? And could these events have something to do with the gods of the ancient world? In our current series, we've been noting the possible connection between events that are occurring throughout the modern world today and the gods of the ancient world. One of those events involves the riots that occurred at a tavern called the Stonewall Inn in June of 1969. Now, these riots led to the gay rights movement that soon afterwards spread throughout our nation, as well as the entire world. One of the points we noted in our last session was that the movement was marked by marches and parades. The concept of parades appeared in the ancient Mesopotamian and Middle Eastern culture. In our last session, we noted the fact that parades were held in honor of the ancient goddess Ishtar. One of the main gates, there are a number of gates to the city of Babylon, but one of the main ones was the Gate of Ishtar. This gate was the starting point of the city's processional way. The processional way extended north from the Ishtar Gate and was designed with brick relief images of lions, the symbol of the goddess Ishtar, also known as Inanna, the war goddess, the dragon Marduk, the lord of the gods, and the bull of Adad, the storm god. Worshipped as the mistress of heaven, Ishtar represented the power of sexual attraction and was thought to be savage and determined. Symbolized by the star and her sacred animal, the lion, she was the goddess of war. Now, in the ancient world, Ishtar was known as the lioness of heaven. The lion carried her into battle. But what does that have to do with anything? Well, it has to do with something Jesus said to an evil and adulterous generation during his earthly ministry. His words appear in Matthew 12, starting in verse 43. Now, when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, it passes through waterless places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, I will return to my house from which I came, and when it comes, it finds it unoccupied, swept, and put in order. Then it goes and takes along with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there, and the last state of the man becomes worse than the first. This is the way it will also be with this evil generation. Now, the generation that Jesus referred to at that time was the nation Israel. The evil spirit returned with seven spirits more wicked than itself, and the last state became worse than the first. Now, in light of that, the question, could this be the case with America today? Is it possible that the spirits of the ancient gods have returned to America? And could it have happened that day at Stonewall? And could the evil influence that spread throughout our nation today, as well as the world, be the result of it all? One of the areas where we could be seeing the results is in the Mardi Gras parades. But as we note in this series, it's also obvious in the changing roles of men and women and the attack that's been launched against our children who are being sexualized through our educational system. Is it possible that this can be traced back to the goddess Ishtar? It's very possible. It might seem too out there to be true, but as we've said many times, we're in a war. And the things that we're talking about today, the things that we're seeing going on today, emphasizes it all the more. There are just too many coincidences. In closing out our last session, we said, as the processions of Ishtar began at the gate of Ishtar, the pride parades began in New York City, the gate of America. The ancient parades in Babylon began at the city wall. The modern day parades began as a result of the events that occurred at Stonewall. The ancient parades in Babylon began at a gate covered with bricks. The front of the Stonewall Inn was covered with bricks. The gate of Ishtar was noted for its depictions of lions, which symbolized the goddess. The lion's head marked the site of the uprising that initiated the modern day parades. Through the gate of Ishtar, the gods entered the city in the form of idols. Now, in ancient times, the worship of Ishtar drew people to her worship. Many of the parades and the practices that are taking place today have a striking resemblance to what took place in the ancient world. According to the ancient writing of Mesopotamia, the people of Sumer parade before you. I say hail to Inanna, the great lady of heaven. They beat the holy drum and the timpani before you. They play the holy harp and timpani before you. The people of Sumer parade before you. The same parades, the similar types of parades that took place in the ancient world are taking place today throughout the world as well. The connection here is obvious between what took place in Sumer and the description of the Mardi Gras parade as we noted earlier. Both involve music, both are characterized by loud festive celebrations, and both share another characteristic as well. The people of Sumer parade before you. The women adorn their right side with men's clothing. The people of Sumer parade before you. The men adorn their left side with women's clothing. All you have to do is look at one of these parades that are going on, and you can see the obvious resemblance. Men dressed as women, women dressed as men. Both were public spectacles of cross-dressing, transgenderism, and homosexuality. Both contained instances of partial nudity as well. I saw that. I witnessed this when I looked at it on the internet. Same characteristics that manifested themselves in the parades of the ancient world have manifested themselves in the modern world today. And this is also evident in the pride parades that took place a few months after Stonewall, which were to be repeated every summer as an annual observance. Coincidence? No, obviously not. What's the connection? Ancient gods have entered the modern world, and after nearly 2,000 years, the spirit of Ishtar that inhabited the parades of the ancient world has manifested itself in the same way today. That same spirit that entered Babylon through the gate of Ishtar entered the modern world through New York City, the gate of America. And from there, its influence spread throughout the world. A demonic influence can be seen in the ancient writings, the poems, and the hymns. According to one ancient text, Ishtar's cross-gendered participants took place in public processions, singing, dancing, wearing costumes, sometimes wearing women's clothing and carrying female symbols. You can even see this portrayed in some of the movies that we see today. Same elements that can be seen in the pride parades, we can see today. We see them in the Sumerian inscription. Look at the Sumerian inscription here. The male prostitutes comb their hair before you. They decorate the napes of their necks with colored scarves. A modern commentary on the inscription says, in order to look more like a woman, some of these homosexual priests let their hair grow long, and then after tightening their hair grips for her, male prostitutes would parade before her, holy Inanna. Their locks of hair at the back are adorned for her. obviously this type of behavior is demon influence. It's obvious. Both cross-gendered men and colored class are element of modern-day pride parades. One Mesopotamian scholar called it a carnival-like procession. Interestingly enough, Mardi Gras Day is the culmination of the carnival season, a weeks-long party of excessive, over-the-top celebrations. A second-century Roman writer, Apuleius, in his novel Metamorphoses, describes the clothing worn by the Galli. The following day, they went out wearing various colored undergarments and turbans and saffron robes and linen garments thrown over them, and everyone hideously made up, their faces crazy with muddy paints and their eyes artfully lined. Some wore tunics fastened with belts with purple stripes flowing in every direction like spears and yellow shoes on their feet. The Galli, we talked about this before, these were eunuchs attired in female garb with long hair fragrant with ointment. Together with the priestesses, they celebrated the great mother's rites with music and dancing until their frenzied excitement found its culmination in self-scourging, self-laceration, or exhaustion. Where did we see that before? We saw it in the case of Elijah and the Baal prophets. But don't miss the fact that these elements are characteristic of the modern-day pride parade in its display of transvestites and drag queens. These events were known for opposing societal norms and distinctions of gender. Well, there's a surprise. Ishtar's modern parades came to be known for the same thing. The purpose involved opposition to convention, and today millions of people around the world participate in it. In doing so, they're following the pattern of the ancient priests and becoming the goddess's servants. And it was not only men who took part in it. The presence of women also played a part in the return of the ancient gods, which is impacting our world today. As the men on these goddess's parades assumed female roles, the women assumed male roles, and they carried into the realm of husband and lover. It followed the characteristics of the goddess. In her nature, she was both masculine and feminine. She transferred herself from one to the other and back again. The change in nature was accompanied by a change in desire. With a crossing of gender and sexuality came the implication of lesbianism. Now, since Ishtar crossed the lines of gender and sexuality, her servants did as well. Lesbianism was present that night at Stonewall Riots, as we noted earlier in this series, and it's also present today in the gay pride parades, of which lesbians make up a large part. Now, this brings us to what we're going to discuss this morning. It has to do with signs. What is a sign? A sign is an object, quality, or event whose presence or occurrence indicates the presence or occurrence of something else. And there are a number of signs that appear in the Bible. After the flood, there was the sign of the rainbow. The rainbow was a sign of God's covenant made with the whole earth. It indicated that God would never again destroy the earth with a flood. Then there was the great sign in Revelation 12, which was a reference to Israel. Also in Revelation 12, we saw the sign of the great dragon, which is a reference to Satan. There's other signs as well. They all indicate the presence or occurrence of something or someone else. But the ones we're about to discuss have a direct connection to the return of the ancient gods into the modern world. One of the most basic ones is the two crosses topped with circles. The intertwining of the two are symbols of the female joined to each other, reference to lesbianism. Its first known appearance in this context appeared in the works of Carl Linnaeus, a Swedish botanist, who used it to represent female flowers. The symbol was taken from the Greeks, who used it to represent metal, copper. Copper was associated with the planet Venus. Venus was the Roman incarnation of the Greek Aphrodite. Aphrodite was the Greek incarnation of Ishtar. The symbol of lesbianism goes back to Ishtar. The Greek poet Sappho worshipped Ishtar. It showed in her writings. Her poetry is filled with elements of the cult, rituals, and the worship of Ishtar. One of her poems, An Ode to Aphrodite, still exists. The Ode to Aphrodite is a lyric poem by the archaic Greek poet Sappho, who wrote it in the late 7th and early 6th centuries BC, in which the speaker calls on the help of Aphrodite in the pursuit of a beloved. Sappho referred to Ishtar as the terrible enchantress. She wanted the goddess to use magic to alter the affections of the other person. But the object of her affection was a woman. In the poem, Ishtar appeared to Sappho and assured her that she would grant Sappho's desire. Interestingly enough, Sappho's place of birth was on the Greek island of Lesbos. This is where the word lesbian came from. Sappho also wrote of girls in flowers, wreaths, and violets worn as a crown or woven around their slender necks. Of all the shades of purple, lavender is that which is most associated with lesbians and the LGBTQ community as a whole. From Sappho, violet became the symbolic flower of lesbianism. One article states, violets were featured in the 1927 Broadway play, The Captive, by Edward Bourdais, following two lesbian lovers with one gifting the other a bouquet of violets as a romantic gesture. After the play was shut down in France, the violet became associated with lesbianism and was dubbed the lesbian flower. Although violet sales diminished due to its association, the flower flourished in popularity among lesbian women, being worn on a woman's lapel to display their romantic intentions. More than once, the writings of Sappho referred to a woman crowned with a garland of violets. Those are references to Aphrodite. This information also pointed to the influence of Ishtar in the modern world. Along with the double crosses in the color of violet, we have the double-edged axe, which I couldn't get on a slide. Labrys, L-A-B-R-Y-S, the double-headed axe, has various meanings and connotations. It was a significant sacred symbol of the Minoan religion, the dominant religion of the Minoan civilization of Crete during the Bronze Age. It was a symbol of the mother goddess, and it signified the authority of women, matriarchy, and female divinities. A woman carrying a double-headed axe in the Minoan civilization indicated she held a powerful position in that society. The Labrys symbol is also believed to represent the Amazons, a warrior society consisting only of women. They were the ones who refused to follow the patriarchal culture. Since the 1970s, the symbol is mainly being used to represent lesbian feminism. The Labrys lesbian flag, created by Sean Campbell in 1999, features a white Labrys on an inverse black triangle with a purple background, and it's used to represent lesbianism. It symbolized women independent of man, taking on the nature and place of men. It became part of the gay pride parades, displayed on banners carried by women who saw themselves as heirs of the ancient Amazons. But here's the point. The double-edged axe is a weapon used in battle. It's pictured in the ancient writings of Mesopotamia, one of which referred to earlier. It says, the people of Sumer parade before you. The young men who carry hoops sing to you. Now, the carrying of hoops is associated with women. These young men were feminized. The hymn goes on to say, the maidens and coiffured priestesses walk before you. They carry the sword. The hymn indicates that the young women and priestesses were carrying objects associated with men. They're serving Ishtar, following her nature by taking on men's roles. As Ishtar carried the sword into battle, and we've already stated it, these women did that as well in the parade. The sword was a double-edged axe. Same weapon carried by women in the ancient world to bend the lines of gender and sexuality. It became the symbol of women in the modern day world to do the same. Only today the weapon is raised up on banners by women who have no idea of who they're serving and the powerful influence that they're under. Now here's where a principle emerges. There is no limit to the disastrous effects that can result when the door is left open to the spirits of the ancient world. Here's where the difference between myth and mythology is in view. A myth is a narrative or a legend that's generally based on faith or folklore at the time. A myth can be fictitious. In order for a myth to be non-fictitious, it has to be supported by truth. Mythology is non-fictional. It's supported by facts, and we're seeing the facts. These facts appear in the ancient writings that we've been noting throughout this series. Another one of these appears in the ancient Mesopotamian culture as well. It has to do with the time of year when Ishtar's mythology, passions, desires, and longings and rituals possessed multitudes. It was the time of the year when her spirit was seen everywhere. It was also as if the people of Mesopotamia at that particular time not only worshipped her, but in their passions, it seemed as if they became her. Now today we call that demon possession. Now as we know, demon possession is not science fiction. Demon possession is very real. The Bible states it. Recall the passage that says the unclean spirit returned to the man with seven spirits more wicked than itself, and what? It lived there. That's a reference to demon possession. Remember Ezekiel's words concerning a vision he was shown, Ezekiel 8, verse 14. Then he brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north, and behold, women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. Now recall that according to mythology, Tammuz was Ishtar's lover, and we noted this earlier in the series. But at one point, she and Tammuz were separated. While Ishtar was in the land of the living, Tammuz was in the underworld. Now during that time, Ishtar longed to be reunited with her lover. The women in this passage wept for Tammuz as if they were Ishtar in their weeping. And that's obviously in the Bible. It was this time of the year when the desires, the longings of Ishtar possessed them. Festivals and processions dedicated to Ishtar and the object of her desire took place throughout the Middle East. During those days, the ancient world was saturated with her presence, and it continued on for approximately 29 days. Now, that period of time of the ancient Middle Eastern calendar was dedicated to the celebration of Ishtar and Tammuz. Carry that over into the modern world. Is the modern world today saturated with the presence of Ishtar? Are there observances to be kept, festivals to be celebrated, and processions to be followed? The answer is obvious. We've just seen it in the Mardi Gras parades. For 1 month, every year, the same celebration is taking place today. For 1 month every year, the modern world is filled with the spirit of the goddess. For 1 month every year, the celebration of homosexuality is practiced. It's called Pride Month, a month when the spirit of the goddess possesses her followers. Now, something that was seen as a form of immorality, something that occupied only the unseen places of society, is today treated as sacred and celebrated throughout the world. Coincidence? No. And it's not science fiction either, and it's not a story based on folklore. It's all connected to the influence of the ancient gods, and it's backed up by facts. The unclean spirit returned, but when it returned, it brought with it seven more spirits, wicked, more wicked than itself. in the ancient world that occurred during the month of Tammuz, which we noted earlier in the series. According to one Bible commentary, this was in accordance with the Jewish calendar. Joseph Benson, an 18th century commentator, writes, Tammuz, which also is used for the 10th month, reckoning from the autumnal equinox, this is the month of June, and Tammuz, as the object of worship, expresses the solar light in its perfection as the summer solstice. When does the summer solstice occur? In June. Some of you might have heard the term Latin Vulgate. The Latin Vulgate is a Latin translation of the Bible. It was written by Saint Jerome. St. Jerome was known for writing Bible commentaries. One of his commentaries was on the book of Ezekiel. Now, as we just saw, the Jewish women who were weeping in the spirit of Ishtar appears in Ezekiel chapter 8. One of those commentaries, Jerome stated, Adonis is called Tammuz in both Hebrew and Syria. Concerning the death of Tammuz, Jerome wrote, in the month of June he was killed. He continued, they call this month of June by the same name and keep an annual festival in his honor. So according to Jerome and others as well, of that day, the month of Tammuz is the month of June, the month in which the annual festival takes place. And as we noted, June is also the month of the annual celebration of Ishtar in the ancient world. And the same principle applies today. Coincidence? I don't believe in coincidences. We're in a war. We're beginning to see that it's far more widespread and intense than we could even begin to imagine. And it's no wonder the Apostle Paul and John said, "Do not be conformed to this world." Pride Month celebrations that are taking place today are not common occurrences. When America turned away from God, the door was left open to an evil power to be unleashed on the nation and throughout the world. And America was the first perfect place to attack, because from there it spread throughout the world. And the women who were involved in those rituals were not alone in their rituals. Another group of individuals played a role as well. They consisted of men who dressed as women, men who would once again take on the attributes of women. The ritual they participated in was not about the union of Ishtar and the object of her affection. It was about their separation. Separation became an obstruction of passion and desire. Similar principle occurred at Stonewall. The riots originated there from an obstruction of desire. The parades that followed were designed to tear down everything that presented an obstacle to fulfill desire. But out of it originated something deeper. The concept of something deeper is always the case when anybody, individual or nation, opens the door to evil. How many times have you heard someone say, let's have just one more, and then we'll leave? And when it's all said and done, somebody doesn't make it home alive. Or what about the person who thinks, I'll try it one time, but I'll never do it again? And somewhere down the line, that person ends up dead from an overdose. Or what about the pitfalls associated with the thinking, love the one you're with? And down the line, it leads to a divorce settlement or something worse. Almost a year ago, I told of a story of a man who had a beautiful family, beautiful wife, a couple of kids. He allowed himself to get involved in a sexual relationship with another woman. It ended up he murdered his wife and his children. Whenever anyone allows themselves to be influenced by an evil spirit, it always establishes the potential for something deeper to occur. The separation of Ishtar and Tammuz pointed to something deeper and sinister. The separation of man and women from each other. The result was homosexuality and lesbianism. That separation became a celebration, a month-long holiday designed to commemorate the separation. But there's still more to come. In the ancient world, the festivals observed in the month of Tammuz were noted for sexual licentiousness. One of the ancient writings states, the women of Gabal used to repair this temple of Aphrodite in midsummer to celebrate the death of Adonis or Tammuz, and there arose in connection with this celebration those licentious rites. Second century Assyrian writer described how the women would shave their heads in honor of Tammuz, and that those who refused to follow suit had to offer their bodies to strangers as prostitutes and give the money to Ishtar as a sacrifice. Usabiyat rites of the temple of Venus or Aphrodite. The votaries of impurity destroyed their bodies with effeminacy. Here, men undeserving of the name forgot the dignity of their sex. Here, too, unlawful commerce of women and adulterous intercourse with other horrible and infamous practices. Question, how far could it go? Well, there's no limit. God created man in the image of God for the purpose of showing forth God's glory throughout an evil society. And God gave man a desire for eternal things and the ability to know right from wrong. But when man keeps choosing against God, man throws off the restraints. Apart from those restraints, what could occur? Read the book of Revelation. Revelation gives us a picture of what can occur apart from the restrainer. It gives us a look into the living hell that will occur on the earth at that time. Jesus said, unless those days were cut short, no life would have been saved. Up to this point, God kept human history going because God has a plan. But there were occasions in the past where God intervened by destroying segments of the population. Why? To keep man from destroying himself. We saw that at Sodom and Gomorrah. That was just one. The midsummer festivals and the processions to Ishtar eventually came to an end. But church historians Eusebius and Socrates Scholasticus record the destruction of the Temple of Venus by Constantine in Lebanon. He likewise demolished the Temple of Venus at Ephaka on Mount Libanus and abolished the infamous deeds which were there celebrated. But these celebrations appear today in the modern world. This return serves as a sign of the returning of the gods from the ancient world to the modern world. In earlier centuries of the church, their return appeared as celebrations of immorality. The same is being seen today. But as we said earlier, there's something deeper involved. And it was religious in nature. As the procession in June was referred to as sacred in the ancient world, it is today as well. What began with the turning away from God evolved into rites and processions of the pagan summer festival. What do you think will happen? Look at Deuteronomy 30, starting in verse 17. But if your heart turns away, and you will not obey, but are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall surely perish. You will not prolong your days in the land where you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess it. Same principle applies today. It was in the month of Tammuz that Israel first turned away from God to serve other gods, gods in the image of the golden calf. Today, June marks the turning away of God by another nation, the United States of America. Somebody used to say there's no standing still in the spiritual life. Those who stand still will eventually fall back. That also applies in the case of nations. Whether the vessel is a person or a nation, the vessel needs to be filled continuously. When you stop filling the vessel, it will become empty. But a vessel never stays empty. Something will fill it. If the filling doesn't come from God, it'll come from the only other system of thinking that exists. We've been noting this throughout the series. In our session this morning, we've noted a number of signs. The two crosses, the color lavender, the double-edged axe. We also discussed the month of Tammuz and its return to the modern world. Now we're going to look at another sign. We touched on it earlier, but in this context, it has an entirely different meaning. Oftentimes, it appears on a flag, but not the flag of freedom. It appears on a different type of flag called the rainbow flag. It was designed by a gay man, a political activist, a designer and flag maker named Gilbert Baker. Baker created the rainbow flag in 1978. Over the next four decades, his creation will become embraced across the world as a universal symbol of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender movement. It appeared a number of times in a number of places. It was even seen being waved by a member of Congress. The original rainbow flag had eight colors, each representing one of the eight colors of the movement. The first color on the flag is pink. Pink represented sex. Ishtar was the goddess of the sexual desire and every form of sexual practice. Second color is red. Red represented life. Ishtar was believed to be the source of fertility and procreation, the fountainhead of all the powers of nature. Third color is orange. Orange is the color of healing. Ishtar is said to be the goddess of healing. Prayers of prescriptions of healing have been addressed to Ishtar. Fourth color is yellow. Yellow is represented by the light of the sun. Ishtar has been closely associated with the celestial lights, one of which was the sun. The Syrian sun god was named Shamash, the Akkadian word for sun. He was Ishtar's brother. She was the sun's twin sister. Oftentimes in her carved images, a sun disk can be seen at her side. Fifth color was green. It represented nature. Ishtar was an embodiment of nature. She represented the forces of nature. Sixth color was turquoise. It represented magic. Ishtar was the goddess of magic. Her name was often invoked in casting spells. We saw that earlier. Seventh color was indigo. Indigo represented serenity. Ishtar was the goddess of storms. Now, that being the case, people came to her altars in search of serenity. Eighth color was violet. Violet represented spirit. Ishtar was a spirit. Violet had a connection to Aphrodite, the violet-crowned princess. Aphrodite, of course, is the incarnation of Ishtar. What's the point? Well, you combine the first color, which represented sexuality, with the last color, which represented spirit, you have the spirit of sexuality. In looking at the rainbow flag on a superficial level, all you would see is a combination of colors. But what does the sign say? It says there's something deeper here. It says that the spirit has such a powerful influence in the ancient world, and it's exerting that same influence today in the modern world. That spirit is the spirit of Ishtar. Now, this brings to mind an attitude from the past. And it appears in Isaiah 14, starting in verse 13. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. And I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. How does this apply today? We already alluded to it. According to the ancient writing, Ishtar was the goddess of the sky, the queen of heaven, the master of tempests, hurler of lightning bolts, the giver of rain. Concerning Ishtar, the ancient hymn states, "Loud thundering storm, you pour your rain over all the lands and all the people." According to the hymn, Ishtar controlled the storm, directed the wind, and caused thunder and rain. What does this suggest? It suggests that the rainbow was under her command and under her direction. Earlier in the series, we asked the question, what's in the name? There's an ancient Elamite inscription that reads, Manzat Ishtar. The inscription translates to the name Rainbow Ishtar. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, in the aftermath of a great rain and deluge, it says, Ishtar also came. She lifted her necklace with the jewels of heaven. Note that word, necklace. It's believed that the necklace with the jewels of heaven is a reference to the rainbow. So after the storm, Ishtar lifted the rainbow up into the sky. In the ancient Babylonian hymn, it says, her eyes are multicolored and iridescent. The rainbow is multicolored. The Latin root iris means rainbow. Iris is also the name of the Roman goddess of the rainbow. This implies that the eyes of Ishtar are like the rainbow. An ancient myth tells the story of the goddess and the gardener. The goddess lied down under a tree planted by the gardener. After falling asleep, the gardener raped her. When she awoke, she realized what had happened. She flew into a rage and began sending down plagues on the earth. She then went to her father to seek help. Her father told her where the gardener was hiding. According to Sumerian literature, in order to accomplish the task at hand, it says, she stretched herself like a rainbow across the sky and reached thereby as far as the earth. The rainbow became the means by which she executed her will. Please go to Ezekiel chapter 1, and we'll be closing shortly. How does all this apply today? Well, it fits perfectly with the thinking of Satan. It's in direct opposition to God, who controls all the elements. God created the heavens and the earth. And as the psalm says, the heavens are telling the story of the glory of God. Creation tells the story of the wisdom and the power of God. God placed the sun in the heavens, and God causes it to rise and set. God makes the clouds, causing lightning to strike across the sky and brings forth rain and wind. Look at Psalm 135, verse 7. He causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth, who makes lightnings for the rain, who brings forth the wind from his treasuries. God placed the rainbow in the sky. The rainbow is under God's control. And look at how Ezekiel described the vision, described it in a vision he was shown, starting in verse 22. Ezekiel 1, verse 22. Now over the heads of the living beings, there was something like an expanse, like the awesome gleam of crystal spread out over their heads. Look at verse 26. Jump down to verse 26. Now above the expanse that was over their heads, there was something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance. And on that which resembled the throne, high up, was a figure with the appearance of a man. Then I noticed from the appearance of his loins and upon something like his loins and upward, something like glowing metal that looked like fire all around within it. And from the appearance of his loins and downward, I saw something like fire. And there was a radiance around him, as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day. So was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face and heard a voice speaking. The rainbow is not a weapon of a war or sign of destruction as it stands today. The rainbow shows forth the glory of God. But today man's rejected the glory of God. Perfect passage for that. Today man has exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man, and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over. What's the result? Depraved minds. Minds that have become totally depraved, filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, and evil. Please go to Genesis 9, and here's where we'll close. Does all this apply? Well, judge for yourself. Judge for yourself. The rainbow, which was a sign of God's covenant, as is pointed out in Genesis chapter 9. If you're there, look at verse 11. Genesis 9, starting in verse 11. I establish my covenant with you, and all the flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood. Neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. God said, this is a sign of the covenant which I am making between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. It shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow will be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. That which is the sign of God's covenant, Ishtar has used as a sign of her power. Those who designed it, carried it out, and choose to serve it as a sign of the movement that was put in motion by the goddess, they have no idea what they're connected to. But this is pretty much the case with spiritual warfare. There's always a bigger picture. And this is why we need to stay as close to God as possible. Let's close in prayer. Father, thank you again for the amazing things that you've taught us. Thank you for opening our eyes, enlightening the eyes of our soul with your scriptures and with the enabling us to see what's going on in this world with clearer vision. Empower us, Lord, to keep learning, to keep growing, to keep being filled with the ability to use the weapons of warfare and apply them correctly. Empower us, Lord, to, with a sense of right priorities, and to and strengthen our priorities, Father, by empowering us to just live for your glory. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.